Well, welcome back to DougHammock.com and to our current podcast project on rethinking sex education. As you know, each week I try and post some thoughts here to get a conversation started about creating a viable, helpful way to educate our young people about sexuality, because what we've been doing doesn't seem to be working. And I do hope you'll join in. I hope you'll comment on both Facebook and or the blog. And I do want to thank those many of you that have. And as I've said, at the end of this project, I'll turn what we learned together into a book. So let's begin this week's episode. Follow-up from last week, Waiting for Sex and Feeling Blue. This is part two. If your young person ever asks for your input about sex, well, rejoice, because what a privilege that will be. But if they will just sit still and listen when you bring it up, that's almost as good. Sex conversations with our young people are tough to have. Now, in this episode, we'll think about creating an environment that can both invite these conversations and help them go well. Influencing our young people is not a right. It is a hard-earned privilege. We earn it when we log time with them. We earn it when we listen to what they have to say, what they are thinking, and we affirm them along the way. We earn it when we give them the attention and the affection and the support that they need. And when we hit the right balance between a firm hand and a gentle one. That's an important element for that would be a starting place for any important conversation, but especially these sex conversations. I heard a saying when I was young that people don't care what you know until they know that you care, which is true. And it's doubly true with young people, and it's triply true when we want to talk about sex. We get ready to talk about sex, all of the conversations that we'll outline in this section, but in particular the conversation about waiting for the timing to be right. We get ready to have these conversations when we create the environment of trust. And that happens when, day in and day out, we love and we sacrifice for and we engage with our young people. Being in our kids' lives, this is what builds trusts. Trust. Loving and sacrificing and engaging, this builds trust. Loving well builds trusts. And we can't have tough conversations, and particularly tough conversations about sexuality, without trust. A little bit of trust goes a long way. One father in our community, as he was getting ready to have these conversations, he told me this story. He said, "When I was young, I approached sex in about as unhealthy a way as I could. I didn't think about the bigger picture at all. I gave no thought to the timing of the psycho-emotional processes or honoring the masculine and the feminine sexuality. None of that stuff. I hurt a lot of women, and in hindsight, I realized I hurt myself as well. But through it all, there was one huge mitigating factor in my life, and that is I could always talk to my dad. At first, I didn't really want to talk to him. I wanted what I wanted. I was too curious. I was too hot and bothered. I didn't want him slowing me down at first. But over time, my sexual journey got painful. It got empty first, but then it started to get painful. And I started to wonder if maybe he had something that I needed. Through it all, I knew my dad was always there. There wasn't any judgment. There was just an open door. Plus, I always knew that he was on my side. When I realized I needed what he had to say, there he was. I learned a lot from him. Much of the sexual health that I enjoy today, I got from him. I regret not listening to him earlier, but more than that, I'm really thankful that he helped me sort things in the end. Trust is a really important thing. We build it when we create a safe environment for our kids to speak freely about their sexual lives. Even if they make unwise decisions, we can help them learn from them, adapt, heal, and grow. Trust is important in our society now, because there are no socially agreed upon rules. Now, as we've seen, history takes a long time to develop rules of thumb that integrate wisdom into our lives. In our generation, we're living between established norms. The old ones aren't working anymore, but the new ones haven't emerged yet. And that leaves us with traditional rules that everybody ignores and the no-norm norms that we're using in the interim. The no-norm norm really is everybody screws everybody as long as nobody gets hurt. But neither one of them is working very well. Now, it might be another 100 years before society develops healthy, functional, and agreed-upon sex rules. Consequently, it's unlikely that any conversation we have in the next 50 years will be the definitive word. We're in for some years of trial, error, learning, and discovering. But that doesn't mean that we don't have something important to say to our young people in this interim stage of history. We do. We've seen in this project that religion has accumulated a great deal of sexual wisdom through the centuries. The wisdom is incredibly valuable. But what we don't have right now is a set of handy, easily transmitted rules of thumb. 100 years ago we did, 100 years from now we will. But now we're stumbling our way forward, trying to find our way. What we have is important. What we have is precious. It's a gift, and it can help shape the sexual conversations that we're going to be having over the next 100 years in our families, at our churches, in our schools, in our community organizations. But in the absence of socially agreed upon norms, we especially need our kids' trust. Because in these conversations, we'll be asking them to stick with us while we're finding our way in uncharted territory. We'll be asking them to stick with us as we thread our way through confusion and social tumult. We'll be asking them to stick with us while there is a chorus of other voices out there with competing visions for how to practice our sexuality. So it's a conversation that can't be insisted. It has to be invited. It has to be engaged. It has to be offered and accepted, which requires trust. When our children are young, we can and we should teach them the rules. That's developmentally what they need. But as they approach sexual maturity, we have to win their hearts, which means we have to win their trust. Ancient wisdom about human sexuality hasn't changed. But the pocket handbook rules that apply that wisdom, they have to change. As we saw in the last episode, traditional sex rules were hammered out in a society that no longer exists. We need new rules that work in this new society, rules we don't have yet, which makes trust an important first step. Also, trust, because we can't depend on taboos. One of the ways that we establish trust is with honesty. And to be honest with our kids, we have to tell them that our world's sex rules are in flux right now. That's true for religion's traditional sex rules, and it's true for society's everybody screws everybody sex rules. If we act as though the rules are firm and fixed and established, well, our words ring hollow because our kids know better. They've heard the competing sexual visions that are out there. A lot of people don't like rules. But what they usually don't like is rules that don't work. Rules that work can be very, very helpful. And in fact, they are the way that human societies transmit wisdom from one generation to another. We figure out what works, we make it a rule, and we teach our young people what the rules are. Now, that's been one of religion's roles. It's been our job to act as guardian of tried and true custom. Religious institutions help us not need to reinvent morality through the centuries. Religion helps us accumulate wisdom and then transmit it in simple rule form, one generation to the next. So thank you, religion, for playing that role through the centuries. But as we've seen, sometimes this noble intent goes badly. Sometimes, instead of helping, religious rules get in the way. And to be honest, religion has behaved kind of badly during this historical transition. When people stopped listening to our tried and true message, we didn't respond all that well. Getting ready for this project, I must have heard 20 separate stories from couples who grew up with traditional sexual norms, true love waits, or abstinence only, or just don't do it. But they also grew up on a steady diet of guilt and a steady diet of shame. If they crossed a sexual line, guilt. If they felt sexual feelings, shame. When they behaved, they had to suppress their sexual urges. When they didn't behave, they felt the shame of their failure. Either way, their sexual stories were all ending the same way, hurt. Religious conversations about waiting have often been feel guilty conversations, or follow God's rules conversations, or shame on you conversations. Now, it's understandable how that happens. Religion figures out what works or what's really important. We figure out what really hurts people when they don't heed it. And to help each other out, we take that good idea and we wrap it in a rule. Do this thing or don't do that thing. It's a rule. And when it's a really important rule, religion adds another layer. We call the rule God's will or something with equal gravity. We take the good idea, we wrap it in a rule, and then we endorse it with divine authority. And once we do that, enforcing the rule gets much easier, because nobody wants to risk divine punishment, and nobody wants to be outgrouped from their religion. So taboos have kind of become our thing through the centuries. And the reason is because forbidden fruit rules, they really work. Now, to be fair, in most generations, taboos are really useful. I spoke to a mom recently who was getting ready for these sex talks with her kids, and she remembered something a relative had said to her during her wild youth. She said, "Young lady," her relative had told her, "you need a healthy dose of shame." Now, at the time, she said, I just rolled my eyes. But in hindsight, I think, you know, a little social pressure could be a good thing. There's a reason why religion uses a healthy dose of shame to modify people's behavior, because it works. Rules work. Shame works. Taboos work. Divine rules can't be challenged. They derive from an unassailable source. So they work. But not for us. We live in an iconoclastic moment in history. In our society, the very existence of a taboo invites its breaking. Forbidden fruit doesn't do for us what it did for other generations. Helping people integrate ancient wisdom into their lives this way, it's kind of run its course for our time. Many religious leaders still try and do this, try and use these practices, but for the most part, folks have just stopped listening. Our kids certainly have stopped listening. Taboo rules were once helpful shortcuts, but they're shortcuts that we can no longer afford. Now they just undercut trust. The work of our time, the work of our generation, it's much harder. We have to strip the traditional rules back far enough that we can understand why they were instituted in the first place. And then we have to apply those underlying reasons in new and helpful ways in the new world that we live in, which, again, that's a much harder job. We have to deconstruct rules and then reconstruct them again. We have to open up forbidden conversations. We have to mention unmentionable things. We have to think unthought thoughts. We have to figure our way forward. Taboo is the antithesis of making our case in the free marketplace of ideas. And making our case in this generation is an essential part of establishing trust. Also, trust, because it's a demanding conversation. As we've seen, the sexual journey unfolds best when we give it the time and the space that it needs. It's a slow process with a lot that has to happen at each one of the stages. So, as we saw in the last episode, whatever our new rule of thumb turns out to be, it'll come out something like this: wait until you're ready, young person, which, again, is a tough conversation. I use an expression a lot when my kids were young. Stupid people don't learn from their mistakes, I'd tell my kids. But smart people learn from theirs. But brilliant people learn from other people's mistakes. So I would trot that expression out whenever they were heading out with their friends on a Friday night. Be brilliant tonight, kid. They'd roll their eyes and we'd smile as they went. Or I'd drop it on them after some knucklehead move that they made. Well, kid, the brilliant ship has sailed. What do you say we try for smart? Sex conversations that factor in the ancient wisdom are really asking our kids to be brilliant. We are asking them to learn from the mistakes made by other people a long time ago, which again makes trust really important. We ask teenagers to be brilliant when we ask them to assess their own maturity before they are mature enough to do it. We ask them to measure their ability to make a relationship work before they understand what's involved in making a working relationship. We ask them to judge their ability to make a commitment before they can see far enough down the road to know what the commitment even is. The conversation about sexual readiness asks young people to distinguish between being ready and feeling ready, because young people feel grown up. And suggesting anything different is always a tough sell. Young people think they are thinking deeply when they aren't. Young people feel they have factored in the big picture when in fact they're blinded by the moment. When we suggest to them that they're not as ready as they think they are, we're asking them to see something they can't see. So again, trust is really important. These are conversations that carry a lot of personal responsibility. We ask young people to consider long-term implications of their actions at a stage in their lives when their capacity for long-term thinking isn't even fully developed. We ask them to consider the full sexual journey when their attention is only focused on the erotic desire. So we're asking them to be brilliant when they're not old enough to be brilliant, which again makes trust really important. Also, trust because we have something to offer. Even though this is a tumultuous time in history, and even though we're hard at work rethinking our sexual norms, and even though we ask our kids to see things they can't see yet, we have some really good things to say. We have a good case to make. That's been the point of this project. We build trust with our kids when we know something useful and when we can offer it to them in ways that they can see and understand and integrate into their lives. In the first two sections of this project, we did the spade work to get ready for these conversations. We worked hard to unearth wisdom from religion and from history and from both the hard and the soft sciences. We did that so we could turn these insights into practical, helpful insights for our kids. Controlling behavior, that's no longer a viable sex education strategy. Just don't do it doesn't work anymore. Sex is dirty, that's even worse. And avoiding the subject altogether because we're uncomfortable, also not helpful. Part of preparing ourselves for these conversations, part of developing the requisite trust to have them, is having something wise and something helpful and something useful and something important to say. And we have it. As we've seen, we understand the sexual journey in a larger context. We've seen how it unfolds through five stages of lovemaking. We saw that in episodes 1-7. We understand that our sexual lives are too big and too deep and too wonderful and too profound to be reduced only to romance or eroticism. And we help our young people see how that whole journey unfolds at a time when all they see is how good sex feels, or how it affirms them, or how it gets them acceptance, or how it validates them. We engender trust when we have something to offer and can make the case to them in ways they can understand. Now, of course, we have to deconstruct how religion has gone so wrong, especially how our dirty sex instincts keep infecting us. But we know how to do that, too. We saw that in episodes 9-12. And despite how many times religion has gotten gender roles and relationships wrong, especially the way that we have mistreated women, we do understand both masculine and feminine sexuality and how important it is to honor both of that. We saw that in episodes 13-14. We engender trust when we have something to offer and we are able to make our case in a way that our young people can understand. We also understand the developmental processes that people go through in order to form healthy pair bonds. We also understand the pitfalls of the contemporary sexual pacing that keeps us from those processes. We saw that in episodes 15-17. Ancient wisdom has a lot to offer, and insight and wisdom and well-framed understanding, these breed trust. So, we older people, we have to learn the ancient wisdom. And then we have to work hard to figure out how to present it to our young people in a way that they can relate to and understand and integrate into their lives. The subtitle of this project is The Wisdom of Religion Without the Crazy. My objective has been to gather here in one place both religion's accumulated wisdom about the sexual life and the crazy that so often shoots us in the foot. My hope is to help us integrate the one and avoid the other and help us develop the insight and the competence that we need to have effective conversations with our young people, because having something to offer engenders trust. Being able to make the case in a way that our young people can integrate into their lives develops trust. Also, trust because we have stories to tell. Storytelling breeds trust. It's a real thing. It happens in all kinds of contexts. One of the most effective ways to establish trust with our young people is to tell them our own stories, our own sexual stories. Now, I know what you're thinking because I've heard it from so many parents before. Come on, Doug, that's crazy talk. I can never talk about my own sex stories with my kids. But relax, because we're not talking about all the gritty details and we're not talking about presenting them with a slideshow. But storytelling is a deeply human thing. It touches a primal place inside of us. Stories naturally build trust. Stories naturally foster affection. Now, in our own spiritual community here, we work hard to tell our stories as an integral part of the spiritual practice of self-awareness. During this project, several parents have been working on stories to share with their kids to get ready for the conversations. They're working on age-appropriate ways to tell their own sexual stories. Stories offer our young people a window into the lives of people they know and love. Stories help them see how sexual decisions get made and then what happens next. Stories teach young people both the lesson that goes with the story, but also how to learn from our own decisions. Sometimes our stories teach us positive and affirming lessons, other times negative, dissuasive lessons. But in both, we have something to offer our kids. We build trust when we examine our own lives and when we explore how our own stories fit into the larger context of the human story. By framing our stories in sync with or at odds with the ancient wisdom, we demonstrate for our kids introspection and learning, and we invite them to bring introspection and learning into their own life stories. Stories are the natural conduit by which human beings share knowledge and experience. Stories are how we share what we've learned. It's how we help. They are how we help one another be brilliant. They are how we help one another learn from other people's mistakes. When we're honest and vulnerable with our kids, which storytelling is, trust is a natural outcome. But that is scary, man. When parents consider telling their stories, a fear that often surfaces is that by talking about our own sexual pasts, we grant tacit permission for our kids to go out and repeat our mistakes. But lurking under that fear is another, that if we don't tell them our stories, if we don't establish trust and share our experience honestly and helpfully, there's every chance that they will stumble into some mistake, if not ours, then another. Our stories can help our kids avoid a great deal of pain. Stories show our young people not only the decisions we made, but also the consequences of our decisions down the line. Again, that's how we transmit experience to young people. And we all have stories, some positive that end happily, others negative that end badly. But both positive and negative, our stories can invite our children into wiser, better paths. Again, we earn the right to be heard when we work out our stories, when we do the hard work of self-awareness and self-understanding, and then when we put our experience into the larger context of ancient wisdom and deepen our understanding of our own sexual journeys and share that understanding with our young people. Stories invite conversations, conversations that are natural conduits for sharing wisdom and experience. Stories reveal much more than lectures do. Stories develop trust. Stories paint pictures. Stories transmit experience and learning. So I really do encourage you, work on your story. Tell your stories to your kids in age-appropriate, developmentally appropriate ways. All right, we'll pick up here next time. We'll talk about how we might shape this conversation about waiting for sex. And in the meantime, what are you thinking? I'd love to hear. Post your thoughts again on the website or on the author Facebook page. Love to hear what you're thinking.